Hello, everyone. Welcome to Longevity Now, the place for all your news and views of life extension from around the world. I have a very special guest on the show today, someone who has been at the forefront in the battle against aging for a couple of decades now, but has never been on the podcast. Most of you are familiar with Reason, founder of Fight Aging. Not only has he provided the most in-depth information in the world of rejuvenation research, but now has co-founded a company to effect change. Find out about Repair Biotechnologies and their efforts to combat heart disease through a very novel method. And now I would like to welcome to the Longevity Now podcast, Reason, the founder of FightAging.org and also founder of Repair Biotechnologies. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
Well, Reason, can we start out with your original idea or impetus to start the company Repair Biotechnologies?
Well, credit where credit is due. The original impetus was my co-founder, Bill Cherman, coming to me and saying, hey, we should start a company, because otherwise it might have taken a lot longer for this to come to pass. Bill's thesis was that if you spend 20 years in a space that's just starting to get interesting, then people know who you are and you know who people are, and all of that can be converted into funding. And he turned out to be right. So
yeah. So was that one of the more difficult things you thought about when you were starting a company? You're like, where do I get the funding?
I mean, honestly, that's a part of it. But the rest of it is, okay, I know a little bit about starting companies before from my past. And I know that this is ridiculously hard, and you need to go into it with a certain amount of willful ignorance regarding what you're about to subject yourself to for the next N years. So I wasn't sort of at that time particularly interested in diving back into that, but I was talked into it, and all for the best, as it turns out.
Well, that's great. And then did the idea for your product, your original product here, the cholesterol degrading platform, was that something you had kind of thought of on your own? Was it in a collaboration with your co-founder or other people you know in the rejuvenation space?
Oh, no. The what are we doing was somewhat late after the we're starting a company. That was company is step one. Then what are we doing was initially we were going to work on the thymus, because that seemed like very interesting low-hanging fruit at the time, and continued to for the next 5 to 10 years, which is the reason why we have now sort of 5 or 6 companies trying to do that. What we did was not really going to get to where we wanted to get easily. And along the way, we picked up the technology that became our current lead therapy. And you reinforce strength where you're in a company. So as things moved forward, we did ever less of the thymus work and ever more of the cardiovascular work as we went forward, until the company was the cardiovascular program. And that didn't take too long, because it was actually really amazing once we got it into animals.
All right. For people who are not familiar with Repair Biotechnologies, could you please give us an overview of your product, your cholesterol degrading platform?
Yes, yes. So, I mean, the header is we reverse atherosclerosis. And that's important because current technologies can't. I mean, and atherosclerosis being the development of fatty plaques in your arteries as you get older, everybody develops it at varying paces. The worse your health generally, the faster it goes. And your existing plaque can't be regressed. There's nothing you can do to reliably regress it. All of the existing approaches to atherosclerosis and cardiovascular disease in general, they can slow the development over time a little bit, but if you have plaque, it's not going away. The average regression over time is zero. And we've developed a way to actually very rapidly regress plaque. And the way you do that is by breaking down specifically free cholesterol inside cells, and we do it in the liver. And it turns out that if you have excess free cholesterol in your liver, then that messes up a lot of things, including your ability to regress atherosclerotic plaque as you might do when you were younger. And it's quite a profound effect, actually. This is the big novel finding for the company, is that if you just get rid of this local excess in the liver, you're doing really, really great. And the current standard of care focused on lowering LDL cholesterol, the transported cholesterol in the bloodstream, that is very, really only loosely connected to how much cholesterol you might have locally resident in some part of your body where it really shouldn't be. over time, over decades, sure. I mean, these things couple to one another, but in the short term of, let's say, I have 5 years of treatment ahead of me before I die from cardiovascular disease, there's only a limited amount you can do to reduce these local deposits. And since the liver is the center of cholesterol metabolism, it turns out that the liver is the place you really want to do this, because then it can dial up everything to do with moving cholesterol around the body in response to a local deficit. And it's like pulling the plug at one end of the bath. The water everywhere heads in that direction.
Okay, so you're saying that the liver is the target for your cholesterol degrading platform?
Indeed. Initially, the plan was, well, we have this really interesting thing that can clearly degrade cholesterol. It must be acting on the plaque, because initially, our initial experiments in animals were with AAV, and AAV, the viral vector, it pretty much goes everywhere. I mean, like all things injected into the bloodstream, it largely goes to the liver, but it does go more or less everywhere. So we were thinking, well, this has to be affecting the plaque. And it was the journey of a couple of years to realize that this really wasn't the case, and that the liver is actually the important target in the effects we're seeing in the vasculature. So long as you can keep the liver thinking that it's at a cholesterol deficit, it will claw back cholesterol from the rest of the body. It will reduce inflammation, and a number of rather unpleasant side effects of having too much cholesterol in the liver go away. And that all conspires to enable the body to very rapidly reduce the size of atherosclerotic plaques in the mouse models, at least.
Well, that's great to hear that you have some in vivo results on this. And it is interesting to hear that it's mainly an action through the liver. And it sounds like your cholesterol degrading platform is upregulating some natural processes in the liver that exist already, but that the liver is not doing, or excess cholesterol is actually interfering with the liver's business.
Yeah, so a cell has only so many things it can do in response to being dropped in an ocean of cholesterol. It can take up less cholesterol to a certain degree. It can esterify more cholesterol to a certain degree and put it into lipid droplets. It can hand off cholesterol to HDL particles to a certain degree. And otherwise, it's a little bit stuck. So it's easy, quote unquote, to get enough cholesterol in one place in the body to overwhelm the local cell's ability to deal with it. And the overflow is what's called free cholesterol, by which we just mean cholesterol. It's just not modified. And when that's inside cells, it's toxic, which is kind of interesting, actually. Cholesterol is obviously, it's needed everywhere in the body. It's in cell membranes. It's used for all sorts of things, but it's actually toxic in its unmodified, untransported state. So too much of it, you have toxicity going on, and cells are stressed, cells are dying. And the most visible signs of this, or the most evident, most well-researched signs of this, are atherosclerotic plaque and liver, the fatty liver, the cirrhotic
Yeah.
liver. That's all. A lot of that is because you have these consequences of just too much cholesterol sitting there, and then free cholesterol inside cells causing havoc. But the free cholesterol is an undruggable target. There's no way to get a small molecule to actually do any sort of meaningful reduction of that, because there's only two options. Either you need to regulate a process that gets rid of it, and there is no such process, or you have to bind to it and sequester it. And there are molecules that do that, but if you put enough of that into the body to actually get rid of a meaningful amount of the free cholesterol in the liver, you disintegrate the blood, you destroy cells, you drag cholesterol out of cell membranes. It would be fatal.
Yeah.
So you need something akin to what we're doing, a gene therapy that produces a very carefully tailored protein that just very selectively only breaks down the excess free cholesterol.
Okay, so that is a gene therapy. I was reading, it's available on your website, repairbiotechnologies.com. It's an AAV delivered gene therapy, and it goes to the liver. And do you have specific targeting that makes it only go to the liver?
So the original gene therapy, the proof of concept gene therapy, was AAV. And there was some thought of taking this forward into the clinic, but that was around the time that people started dying from high dose AAV in clinical trials. So high dose AAV is now not really in favor with investors and the FDA. I mean, it's still being used for all sorts of local administration. And if you can produce something that goes away from the liver and targets other tissues, people are still exploring that. But anything that's liver targeted, AAV is now off the table, effectively.
Okay, good to know. I
So
wasn't unaware of that.
we moved on to lipid nanoparticle mRNA. as our delivery system, which is sort of the least worst in the Goldilocks exploration of what you can do. There's the Goldilocks situation in gene therapy is that you can get short-term expression, you can get very, very long-term expression, but you can't really get in the middle. There's no good delivery system and technology that lets you get middling degrees of a few months of expression, let's say. Bit of a challenge. So you either do AAV and it lasts forever, or you do something like mRNA and it lasts a few days, and you just keep dosing until you're done with the dose regimen.
I'm not sure if you can answer this, whether or not there's proprietary information here, but you recently partnered with a company that does lipid nanoparticle delivery. And is the do that can they tailor these LNPs to specifically get taken up by cells in the liver? Is it not that specific?
Oh, absolutely. You can absolutely specifically do that, and you kind of want to. It's actually not necessary. The AAV is pretty much a blunt tool. It largely goes to the liver, but it will go everywhere else as well. And that's perfectly safe because if your vector happens to end up somewhere that's where there's no excess cholesterol, the drug does nothing in that location. It just sits there until the protein goes away naturally. But the FDA is a bit of a stickler for if your drug goes somewhere, now you get to prove it's not doing any harm there. So it's much easier to have a very selectively liver-targeted system of delivery. So then you don't have to prove that it's not doing anything anywhere else. You just have to prove that it's not going there. So yes, there is a proprietary way of doing this, but the more interesting thing to talk about than that is actually, we're with this company because they had something ready to go that evades the problem that most lipid nanoparticles require functional LDLR and APOE genes in order to get taken up into cells. And by most, I mean near all. There are very, very few lipid nanoparticles that don't have that limitation, and probably only two that are ready to go to the clinic. And of those, one is not available for licensing. So, we go with the people who can give us what we want. But the LDLR gene is important because half the mouse models don't have that. And the human disease, familial hypercholesterolemia, involves loss of function in this gene. And the APOE gene is important because that's one that's knocked out in the mainstream mouse model of atherosclerosis that everybody uses and everybody's going to expect you to go produce data in. It's a little bit of a challenge, but that's how we surmounted it.
And your in vivo results in mice, did it show any off-target effects, any kind of side effects that you are concerned about?
I mean, not unless you load it up to the doses, which you always have to. You find a dose at which you're going to cause problems. But
Yes, the
in our
toxic.
case, in our case, those doses are way, way above where you'd actually dose for efficacy. So,
Okay.
you have to start dosing at 10 times the sort of reasonable efficacious dose in our studies before you're going to start seeing problems. And those problems don't come from our part of the gene therapy. Because as I said, if the protein can't find cholesterol to break down, it just sits there and does nothing. The problem is always the lipid nanoparticle. There's always, for any lipid nanoparticle, there is a dose you can put in there that will cause problems. There's some dose that's high enough to do that.
Okay, and then the protein, is that an endogenous protein that you're just upregulating more with your platform?
It's a combination. It's a fusion protein. It's a combination of existing proteins that don't express in combination. And these proteins are native proteins. You just never see them all at one time in any one cell.
Okay, and now let's move on to a little bit more about the whole situation in rejuvenation research, progress, or no progress over the last 20 years. As you know, I've been in, in the advocacy area for over 20 years now, and I sometimes look at the news and what's available and the therapies and the biohacking, and I think, wow, in 20 some years we have not seen much progress. And in regards to, I can't go to my local pharmacy, I can't go to the hospital and say, hey, give me this, rejuvenation treatment. The doctor will look at me like I was crazy. He's like, what? Nothing like that exists. It's not, there's nothing proven, widespread in the market that people can take that has a proven rejuvenation effect in the human body. Now, there are some people who are biohacking with, some rather experimental therapies that seem to have some effects, but they're not widespread and they're not commercially available. What would you say? You've been doing this a long time as well, and you've covered the news more in depth and the research more in depth than most people. What's your long-term view here in 20 years? Is it pretty positive, or are you a little bit disappointed in how much progress has occurred?
I think pretty positive. We've had 10 years of a marketplace, and really that's not enough time to get anything approved. It takes a good 15 years to go from very start to very end to get a drug out there in the marketplace. So for anything other than rare diseases. So really one should expect, 2030 is where you have like a brace of the earliest therapies coming out of the longevity industry. And so 2030 to 2040, you're going to see a whole set of first and second generation therapies out there. And then people can start to actually say, well, okay, how good are they? We can start to actually put some measurements in place. But epidemiological data, that's not going to turn up for another 20 years after that, because nobody's much incentivized to. So you're not going to know, really what are you getting in terms of lifespan. You're going to know short-term biomarkers. And clocks are a ferociously well-developed, aging clocks, ferociously well-developed area at the moment. And I would expect 10 to 20 years from now, you'll have clocks that are really actually very well validated. And we can have a much better expectation that if a clock number is going to tell you something real about what's happening to your health, as a result of the therapies you're doing. And all along the way, there are gray areas. I mean, one person's widely available is not the same as another. One person's easily accessible is not the same as another. It's perfectly possible to go out there and use many of the easier therapies that are sort of, the first generation technologies that were used in animal studies and are being used by self-experimenters or are being prescribed off-label by doctors, particularly senolytics. And I would imagine that fecal microbiota transplantations and other ways to affect the microbiome in positive ways will spread slowly over the next 10 years, now that we have good ways to measure that. And there's a couple of others, like use of rapamycin and so forth, that are age slowing and not so much rejuvenative. But there's a lot out there that you can do today, a lot more than there was 10 years ago, and certainly vastly more than there was 20 years ago. And the accessibility is much improved these days, too. If you want to do the digging and go find an anti-aging physician, you can get prescribed dasatinib and quercetin. You can get prescribed rapamycin these days. You just have to go dig. It's not in the mainstream, but it is approaching the mainstream of anti-aging medicine.
So yeah, if you have the drive, you can find it. And if you have the money, you can certainly purchase it for some first generation rejuvenation therapies. And I believe, am I correct in saying you did try the dasatinib and quercetin combination?
Oh yeah, I use that every 6 months or so. It's an ongoing experiment.
Ongoing experiment, and it's been going for a little while. What can you say about the results?
I can say that, as a person in your 50s, you're probably not going to see any difference unless you're very out of shape. If you're a person in your 80s, everything works pretty much. The people I know who are in very late life who have gone out there and tried things, there's some who've tried everything from exosomes to stem cell therapies to senolytics to, a bunch of stuff that I would throw out as garbage, but pretty much everything works if you're 80. You're damaged enough that the effect sizes become measurable and noticeable. Whereas if you're in decent shape at 50, you're never going to see anything from most of these drugs. The only things that become really interesting are the earliest aging parts of the body, like the thymus, ovaries, and I dread to mention skin, but that's also one where you see earlier signs of aging that are more measurable. And that's all interesting and worth doing. The only other thing you can really try are the clocks. You can try the aging clocks, do things and see what the clocks say. But at the moment, the clocks are just, nobody knows what they're really measuring.
So exactly.
If you get a result, but what does that mean?
Do you do any of that testing? Have you done any biomarker testing or functional biomarker?
I think that the phenotypic clock is a good one. I kind of like that one because it dovetails nicely with simple, low-cost blood work. So you can just do pretty low cost blood work that you don't even have to talk to a doctor for. You just go to Quest or whatever and get it done. And it's less onerous in terms of expense than, let's say, going and doing a true diagnostic epigenetic clock test. But they're two completely different things, of course. And optimizing one may not be optimizing the other. And it's more just sort of a data point to say, that's interesting, right? And then the other value of the phenotypic clock is that components of it are actually sort of measures you get out of blood. And you can look at the rest of it and say, huh, that's interesting. That's why this number got lower, that particular thing right there. And so you can start to hypothesize about what you did, in fact. So for example, taurine supplementation, I tried that because while supplementation is kind of boring from my perspective, simple tests, if you're waiting for something else to happen, are easy to do. They're cheap. You don't have to really run around and do much work. And if you've got other things on your plate, then you can still get it done. So I did taurine for 6 months and measured everything. And the phenotypic clock showed a reduction of a couple of years. And that arises from a reduced number of a specific type of immune cell. So you can look at that and say, well, okay, that happened. Now we can hypothesize what was going on in there. And that leads you in the direction of, reduced inflammation, reduced inflammatory signaling, reduced oxidative stress, that sort of mechanistic hypothesis about what went on. And that's a lot more useful than an epigenetic clock where, you get a number back and okay, great, you get a number back.
Yeah, that's true. Well, can you give us lastly anything we should look forward to with Repair Biotechnologies coming up in the near future, in the next few months, next year or two? Any papers coming out or any other further collaborations you can talk about?
Well, we're aiming to start clinical trials in early 2026 in a rare disease. So between now and then, it's a ferocious period of raising money, just stupendous, ridiculous amounts of money needed for the regulatory process and delving wholly into IND enabling studies and very expensive GMP manufacturing. That is the whole of the game from now until you get there. The goal is, of course, to get a human result, because at that point, you've convinced the world that this is actually how cardiovascular disease should be treated. And from there, it should be possible to hand it over to the big players and not have them just can it on a whim and actually earnestly, pursue getting this out there into the broader market.
Okay, well, Reason, thank you so much for the explanation about the company and your product and the timeline there. I'm sure a lot of people will continue to watch that very closely. Thanks for joining us on the Longevity Now podcast.
Pleasure.
Reason has done a great service for humanity, highlighting and arguing for a cure to aging for the last couple of decades. He has now gone even farther to create a better future by founding a company to bring therapies to market. This is not easy, but it is what it takes in order to solve the complexities of biological aging. We could sure use a lot more help to move things along quicker. Take a look at your life. Could you find a little extra time or funds to contribute in meaningful ways? I hope so. Until next time, I'm Justin Lowe.